This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
I've been working with a nurse dietitian for the last 6 months, and it's been life-changing. I've lost weight, healed my relationship with food, and have way more energy. Working with a dietitian online to create a personalized nutrition plan was so easy thanks to Nourish. The best part? I pay $0 out of pocket because Nourish accepts hundreds of insurance plans. 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Find your dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out, procrastination, putting it off, kicking the can down the road. In, plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out, carpet in the bathroom. Like, why? In, knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Patrick Penfield joins us now, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, to talk about tariffs. How you doing, professor?
Good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm great. Let's talk about, I don't even know what the state of tariffs is today, because you'd have to keep a scorecard like you're charting a baseball game with at-bats and hits and who does this and who does that. I don't even know where tariffs stand right now. Can maybe we start with who's got a tariff on who? Who counter-tariffed? And where all of that stands before we talk about effects on supply chains?
Yeah, we can try, Tommy. I'm just as much in the fog as you are.
What time is it? Let's see, right? What time is it we'll talk about tariffs?
Exactly. So what we do know this time is there's the 10% that's supposed to be a universal tariff on everything that comes in. Unless it's the United States, Mexico-Canada agreement, so that doesn't get hit with that 10% tax. But everything else
because of the countries that are involved in the agreement or products that are included in that agreement?
So the countries involved in the agreement. So the only thing that isn't covered is automobiles and auto parts. So those are still going to get hit with a 25% tariff. And then you still have the steel and aluminum that we're getting hit with, that Canada is getting hit with from a tariff standpoint also. So, it's like you said, Tom, you need a scorecard just to keep things straight, because every day something changes. And then you have the other countries that get hit with the tariffs enacting more tariffs. And so it's just, it's mind boggling.
So let's talk about how tariffs, first of all, how the economy and how supply chains, let me put it this way, how supply chains operate in a worldwide manner. And if you want to do it by product, we can do it, cars, for example, or steel or whatever. But how our everyday life in the United States and the supply chains that fuel that everyday life are impacted by international trade. And then from there, we'll talk about the effects of tariff on international trade.
Sure, absolutely.
And here's why, Professor. Let me just say this for the audience. You can be in favor of tariffs, you can be against tariffs, but the effects are going to be real, and I'm just trying to figure out what those effects will be. With that being said, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so Tommy, the issue is this, is that anytime you hear of tariff, it's a tax. So somebody has to pay that, and that's the dilemma, right? So, if the United States enacts tariffs or other countries do, so somebody's got to pay for it. And so normally what happens is that stuff, when it comes into to our country, let's say, for example, automobile parts, and let's say it's coming in from China, that tax gets hit as soon as it hits the port. And so, you know, the port folks have to make sure that they, you know, are charging the right people, and the customer will pay for it, whoever's buying those parts. And then those parts will go into an automobile, and then the automobile companies will say, hey, look, you know, we've got to make a profit. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to charge more for that particular car. So all in all, what happens with tariffs is basically prices go up. And so that's what your listeners can expect, you know, when they hear that tariffs have been enacted. Somewhere along the line, if those tariffs stay in place, somebody has to pay for them. And usually it's the consumer. We usually call it a regressive tax. And so that's unfortunately what, you know, a lot of us will be seeing here in the United States probably in the next couple of months if the tariff stays as is. And that's the dilemma. Things are changing, and it causes issues within the supply chain because you don't know what to do. And if you're a company, you know, you may try to take action, maybe try to source domestically or possibly source from another country. But if they keep shifting and changing, it's a disruption. And that's a cost. And so it's not easy just to turn one supplier on, turn another supplier off. You know, you've got tooling, you've got machines, you've got equipment. So it's very complex, you know, with some of these supply chains. It's not easy to move things.
Is it incorrect to say this is, when you get down to it, it's a different type of sales tax?
Absolutely. That's probably the best way to state it. And so, unfortunately, you know, we're really dependent on Asia for a lot of stuff. Some of the stuff, you know, you don't want to bring back in the United States, you know, T-shirt manufacturing or, you know, making buttons or, you know, things of that nature. But we're really very dependent on Asia for a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff that's in the stores comes from Asia. And unfortunately, they're the ones that are going to be seeing the massive tariffs.
So who wins, I guess, is what I'm thinking. If President Trump is using this as a negotiating tool, when it comes to the other countries and tariffing our products and import exports, who's got the advantage, whether it's Mexico with auto parts, as I understand it, Canada with steel and aluminum? Who's the other country in the free trade? Mexico, Canada, and who's the third one?
United States. That's it. Yeah.
United States. That's right. Yeah. So who's got the advantage when it comes to who needs what more than the other guy needs? Because that's what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about I tariff you, you tariff me. But I have the advantage over you, so you have no option but to bend to my tariffs. Or maybe I need you so bad that I have to bend to your tariffs. And then ultimately, the only people that are paying for this are the consumers in Mexico, Canada, and the United States. We'll pick it up there when we come back. 620 Traffic Now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about tariffs because it's going to affect everybody's life. Patrick Penfield, our guest, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, our friend. Professor, I asked you before the break, when it comes to I'll tariff you, you tariff me, does it come down ultimately to who needs who more and who's got the advantage over whom, who's holding the best cards?
Absolutely, Tommy. So between the three countries, and Tommy, so your listeners know, our three largest trading partners, Mexico, Canada, China.
Okay.
So they're the ones that we do most of our trade with. And so Mexico and Canada, absolutely, the United States has leverage over those two countries. Now, that being said, you know, this is kind of the dilemma. You know, we hold a lot of the cards. And so, again, if we were to go on with the proposed tariffs and not, you know, focus on the United States, Mexico, Canada, a free trade agreement, it could cause their economies to go into recessions. So this is really kind of a tough situation, but we're very dependent on those two countries also. So when we raise tariffs on them, they raise tariffs on us. And so unfortunately, because all three countries are intertwined from an economic standpoint, this is going to cause major issues within supply chains, especially from a cost standpoint.
I don't mean to get out of my lane here, but it would seem as though if there's a recession in Mexico and the economy tanks there, then you're going to have more people trying to cross the border. Is that a reach or not?
That's possible. I think the Trump administration is trying to put in place ways to prevent that, but that potentially could happen.
Okay,
let's
talk about this Forbes magazine article that says, and it's not a typo, that if Apple were forced to make iPhones in America, a phone would cost between $30,000 and $100,000. And it said, no, this is not a typo. Talk about that, Professor, about what we get from China and if manufacturing of the goods in China, and you said we don't want T-shirts to come here, but a lot of people are behind the president's tariffs and they're saying it's going to bring all manufacturing back to America. If it does and it goes to the price that you pay for labor, et cetera, or the United States having to import whatever it takes to build iPhones or whatever from other countries with tariffs, what could that do to prices of some items that we use every day, if you wanted to pick some?
Yeah, I would say your items are going to go up dramatically, and you brought up a good example of the iPhone. So your electronics, furniture, apparel, sneakers. Tommy, if the tariffs stay as is, your listeners are going to be shocked, and then probably you'll see the price change in August. Back to school shopping, that's when prices are going to just dramatically skyrocket, if the tariffs stay in place. And that's just because most of the stuff that's in the stores these days is from China and Asia. That's where we get our furniture, our clothes, our sneakers, our shoes. So Tommy, I'm a big proponent of manufacturing. I love manufacturing. I want to see more of it here in the States. But the stuff we should be manufacturing, Tommy, we should be focused on the defense industry, pharmaceuticals, medical device, automobile manufacturing. That's the stuff that creates wealth. That's the stuff that has high-paying jobs. Some of the stuff, making buttons, making sneakers, that stuff doesn't pay well. And so, unfortunately, that's stuff that really the United States really shouldn't focus on or concentrate. The other thing, Tommy, is look at our unemployment rate. It is really low. All right, so if we brought all this stuff back to the United States to manufacture, one, it would cost probably anywhere from 75 to 100% more than it costs now. You would have a difficult time trying to find people to work, and so it would cause a lot of issues and lots of problems. So it's just not realistically possible for that stuff, all of it, to come back to the United States to be manufactured.
That's how I want to wrap this up, because for people that are thinking that the tariffs are going to lead to all manufacturing coming back to the United States and every product being made here, what you just said is, with the unemployment rate so low, in order for manufacturers to get people to work, they're going to have to pay them a lot more to make T-shirts or buttons or sneakers. And if that's the case, those prices are going to soar. So if all manufacturing were to return to the United States, and if that's what people want and they think that's the end goal of tariffs, the result would be, when it comes to prices?
Oh, at least 100, 200% increase.
On everything?
Everything, yeah. Which would be ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the dilemma that really the impact that people don't see is again, just how much more it would cost, to make that happen here in the United States. It is realistic.
And you can't compare today's economy, today's world economy, to 100 years ago, can you?
You cannot, Tommy. It's a different world. It really is, and that's the issue. That's the dilemma. The only saving grace that we might have is automation, right? But when you bring automation, and automation's coming, and then it's going to displace workers. So it's like a 1-2 punch. And it's not advisable. It's not realistic. It doesn't make sense, for us to manufacture everything here in the United States. It just isn't the way the world is built these days.
I didn't think so. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Pleasure as always. Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. We'll talk about tariffs and Louisiana energy when we come back. 6:30, time for WWO First News. 6:44, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, beautiful day. Mother's Day, I just looked up, is May the 11th. And I always remember Mother's Day as a slap in the face of summertime. It is always miserably hot and humid on Mother's Day, so that's coming. And the only reason I mention that is today's April 8th. The weather's going to be beautiful, as it will be this week. So get out and enjoy it while you can. Greg Upton joins us now, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. How you doing, Greg?
Doing good. Just trying not to look at my 401k, but other than that, it's great. How are you, Tommy?
Well, you're a long way from retiring. Don't look at it. It'll come back. It will, over time.
Absolutely.
Of course, the problem with that is, and this has nothing to do with tariffs, this is just as a guy a little bit farther down the road than you, and having gone through some of the big market tankings, is that the 401k goes down, but then it comes back up. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, inflation continues to eat away at it. So while you might have had, let's pick a number, 500,000 2 years ago, now it's 250,000. Well, maybe in 5 years it'll go up to 500,000 again. But meanwhile, inflation has kind of eaten away at you. But don't worry about that, Greg. Let's talk about just telling you. Let's talk about tariffs and Louisiana energy and how that could affect what happens in Louisiana? I don't even know what tariffs apply to who and what how when it comes to Louisiana energy. Thoughts?
Yeah, so last Wednesday, President Trump came out with his announcement on reciprocal tariffs. And there was the announcement that he made, and he put up actually this chart of all of the different countries in the world and what the reciprocal tariff was and kind of how he calculated that. So let's kind of back up to Econ 101, what is a reciprocal tariff? So the idea is that suppose that, the Federation of Tommy Tucker decides to give a tariff to the United States of Upton of 10% on all products. Mm-hmm. And I might come to you and say, hey, Tommy, why are you putting this tariff on my products that I'm selling to you? I would really like if you would not do that. And so what I might do is say, well, in the meantime, while you're implementing this tariff, I'm going to go up and at the same time put up a 10% tariff. But I'm going to tell you at that time that all you have to do in order to get rid of my tariff is to remove yours. And so that's kind of the idea with reciprocal tariffs, is not to escalate a trade war, but instead to actually try to reduce tariffs globally. And so that's kind of the theory with it. So that's what, President Trump came out and said. He had these reciprocal tariffs, and he puts in the chart. He says these are tariffs charged to the USA, including country currency manipulation and other trade barriers. So I said, oh, this is really interesting. Let's go and kind of see how he calculated this. So I went to the White House document. I got my research team to replicate the analysis. And kind of what was interesting is that the tariffs that he put on actually had nothing to do with reciprocal tariffs. In fact, had nothing to do with tariffs that other countries had, nor anything to do with the currency manipulation or other trade barriers. It was really a simple calculation in terms of how much exports that country has relative to its imports to the U.S. And so countries that are larger net exporters to the United States were putting a larger tariff on. So that was kind of it's not really clear, how this is reciprocal and how this is going to get countries to change their policies if it's not a specific policy that he's targeting here.
So I'm trying to understand what you said. So while the president said it was about reciprocal tariffs, you dug deep and found that it was about exports, and that's the difference?
Yeah, it's really not a reciprocal tariff at all. And so now kind of what we're watching is, okay, well, how are countries going to respond to this? Are countries going to come to the table and ask the administration, hey, what are the changes you want us to make internally in order to be able to negotiate and get that lower tariff rate? Or are you going to see countries do what you would more traditionally think, which is, well, the United States just put this tariff on them, and then, okay, will they respond by putting a tariff in return and then telling the United States the way to get rid of this tariff is to reduce yours? And so this has just created an enormous amount of kind of uncertainty with that global supply chain as these tariffs come on.
So
and it's not really clear what the channel to reduce them is.
So when it comes to other countries initially putting the tariffs on us, I'm looking at the chart that President Trump held up. Tariffs charged in the U.S., to the U.S., 67%, China, European Union, 39%, Vietnam, 90%, 64%, Taiwan. Why would the, and then it goes on from there, why would countries, I don't understand why they would put tariffs on us initially. How did that start?
Well, they didn't. I mean, they did not. And that's what's kind of confusing about the chart, is that it says explicitly that this number is tariff charged to the U.S., while when you go look at the calculations, that just literally is not what the calculations are. In fact, that doesn't even go into the calculation. And so this is kind of the confusing part, and I think why markets are really responding in this very volatile way, because it's not clear how do countries even approach the United States in order to negotiate a lower tariff rate, when that's actually not what the calculation is.
So the chart he's holding up says tariffs charged to the U.S., China, 67%. You're saying China does not charge the United States 67% tariffs?
That is correct. That calculation that is used for that has nothing to do with tariffs.
The European Union, 39% tariffs, not true?
Not true. That's correct.
Vietnam, 90%. Not true.
Not true.
Okay. So we'll take a break, come back, talk about what happens from here. Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. President Trump, just to be fair, has been known, going back to the hurricane map, to kind of stretch the truth and bend things occasionally. So we'll talk about more about Louisiana and tariffs when we come back. 6:51, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:57 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. For those of you that are texting in, taking issue with Greg, I would suggest you look up the American Enterprise Institute. Google that. That is about as conservative of a think tank as you can find. And it says that even if one were to take the Trump administration's tariff formula seriously, it makes an error that inflates the tariffs assumed to be levied by foreign countries fourfold. As a result, the reciprocal tariffs imposed by President Trump are highly inflated as well. And then there's an equation, and I'm going to try to read it, Greg. It says, triangle, capital T, small I, equals X with a little I, dash M with a little I, and over E, I guess it's an E, with an asterisk, some symbol I've never seen before that could be hieroglyphics, asterisk, M, and a little I. So for those of you that think it's simple, please Google AmericanEnterpriseInstitute.org. Look up tariff policies. That is a conservative think tank. That's not some liberal this or left-wing that. I'm just saying in terms of credibility, et cetera. So, Greg, when it comes to Louisiana's energy industry, do tariffs have an effect on oil or gas?
Yeah, so this has been something we've been digging into a lot the last few days. And I've been talking to a lot of companies that, of course, have an international presence. So as you and I have talked about many times, Louisiana is a large exporter of these energy products all over the United States and all over the world. And it doesn't just include the, you know, kind of liquid fuels and energy like we think about it, but also includes plastics and fertilizers and all of these and chemicals and all of these products that are derived from hydrocarbons. And so I'll give you an example. I was literally last week after the announcements came back, I was speaking at a little meeting, little community meeting, and I talked with three firms in the petrochemical industry that were there. And I went and looked after, and these three firms were combined in over 130 countries.
Thank you, Greg. All right, a problem, technical glitch with Brooke there. We're going to talk to her again at 7:40 and get a live update from Augusta National and what the golf course looks like. She's had a look at it after Helene, because when it comes to Amen Corner and a lot of those holes, the iconic holes, Helene, the hurricane, wreaked havoc, and there was some talk about it might look different, so we'll find out in the next half hour. Right now, Jerry Bologna joins us now, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. How you doing, Jerry?
Doing well. Feels like it was just last week when we last spoke.
It does. Are you a golfer or not?
I am. I actually serve on the board of the Four Kids Foundation, who puts on the Zurich Classic here.
Have you been to Augusta?
I have not. Still a bucket list for me.
All right. Well, we'll get an update. Stay tuned. We'll get an update from Brooke on what the course looks like. It is a bucket list for me as well. Let's talk about what's going on in Jefferson Parish with some of the different groundbreakings that are going on, because we got there was so much last week we didn't get to some of the things we wanted to talk about. So let's talk about, I guess, what, the Oracle groundbreaking in Fat City happened?
Yeah, that was a great announcement we celebrated last week, in that that's a company that is a manufacturer of automotive lights. They've been in Fat City for a long time, just sort of growing piecemeal, but they've acquired some additional property in Fat City, investing $3 million in a new 15,000-square-foot facility there. But what's exciting about that is those improvements in Fat City have taken place over the years. And the parish has invested in infrastructure and road improvements and things like that. And now we're really starting to see those businesses invest. And so I think we're at a tipping point there in Fat City finally.
That sounds awesome. Let's talk about the berry chi tree expansion. What is that?
Berry cherry tree, which
berry
is
cherry tree.
Probably one of the largest early childhood education centers in the state. But they are now cutting the ribbon on their fifth building in Jefferson Parish. And And we don't, I wouldn't say we traditionally talk about child care centers in economic development, but we understand that access to that early childhood education is critical for economic development. If business owners and employees can't find access to quality child care, they're not going to be good employees at the end of the day. So we're really excited about this one. Berry Cherry Tree has been in operation for over 50 years in Jefferson Parish, and to see them continuing to expand is a good sign for us.
What about the off-bottom oyster brand launch? I know you wanted to talk about that, but the weather had put that off, Jerry?
Yeah, we were planning to announce that last week. Certainly high tides and choppy waters prevented us from being out there. So we have rescheduled that to later this month. But what we're doing there is really creating an umbrella brand for all of the Grand Isle off-bottom oysters. There are a number of oystermen down there who harvest under their own labels, boutique labels. But we're trying to give Grand Isle oysters their own brand, so that when people go in restaurants, they know what to ask for. And these are a quality, really premium product, harvested off the bottom of the water. They're actually harvested in cages on the top of the water. Sustainable, great product. You can eat them right out of the water, and that's what we'll be doing on that date.
How new of a thing is this, the Grand Isle? It's a new technology, Jerry, and why Grand Isle? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it really. So in Grand Isle, the oyster fishermen or oyster fishing in Grand Isle has dwindled to basically nothing. It's not passed down from generation to generation anymore, but because of hurricanes and other reasons, we're not having a lot of oyster fishing down in Grand Isle, and so they really set this process up where the larvae are harvested in a lab. They're then caged, and the cages actually sit at the top of the water, and the oystermen are in the water constantly turning the cages. They grow much, much faster there. Again, like I said, just a sustainable source of raw oysters, and they are so salty and so good, a real premium product that we're excited to be able to bring to market, but also to be able to retain that skill and that set of skills in Grand Isle and bring oyster fishing back there.
I don't mean to get, I started to say, too far in the weeds or maybe too deep in the water here, but I'm just curious about oysters, and I don't want to ask you about something you don't know about if you don't, but because we hear about salinity impacting the oyster fishermen, but Grand Isle would be the Gulf, which would be nothing but salt water, yes?
That's correct. That area is ideal because of the salinity of the water, but also in that Caminata Pass in that area, it's shallow water. And that was one of the problems with the hurricanes. It comes through, it scours the bottoms of the water bottoms, and it's too deep. But that Caminata Pass, those oystermen can stand in there, harvest those oysters, turn the cages, and really farm their product.
Is there any name for that yet, or is that yet to be announced?
Well, there is a name. That's what we're going to be unveiling, and we had hoped to announce it last week. But we have international media, local media going down there with us later this month, and that's when the brand will officially be unveiled.
All right. Have you had any of these or not? Have you tasted them?
I have had them directly out of the water. And they're great, great product. I think the public, it's going to be a product that people want to see in restaurants and are going to start asking for by name.
I got an idea for you. Some kind of outfit where you'd have to sign God knows how many liability waivers here and provide them with the necessary protective gloves. But how about it's a restaurant where you go and you get your own oysters out of the cage, open them, and just enjoy them right there on the beach?
Well, as someone who has tried to shuck oysters before, I'll let you run with that idea. That's not an easy job.
Well, I said there would have to be some liability waivers and some protective gloves involved, because we used to, every night before Thanksgiving, we get a sack of oysters and have a couple of beers and shuck them for the dressing and then eat them and have a great time. And then somebody put an oyster knife through their hand and wound up at the emergency room, and that pretty well killed that tradition. But it was nice while it lasted, I'll tell you that. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Talking about development in Jefferson Parish with Jerry Bologna, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jerry Bologna, Executive Director of JEDCO, Jefferson Parish Economic Development Commission. Jerry, in terms of development in Jefferson Parish, you guys seem to be on a roll, huh?
It's been a great start to the year. Certainly, it started with the Super Bowl and Jefferson Parish kicking off their bicentennial year. But everything from Riley Foods moving their headquarters to Jefferson to UBE announcing a $500 million investment. The first quarter of this year and into April have really been great for us.
Tell me about what else is going on in Jefferson Parish, some of the other things.
Well, I just mentioned Riley Foods, which not a lot of people may know the name, but they certainly know Blue Plate Mayonnaise and Louisiana Tea and Evermore Water. All of those brands are Riley Foods. They consolidated all their operations into Jefferson Parish. Renegade Construction moved and consolidated everything from their prefab to their offices in Jefferson. So it's a strong time, and companies are investing in Jefferson. They're finding a great business environment and the ability to find a quality workforce. At the same time, you know, we're spending a good deal of time just sort of monitoring tariffs. It's very nuanced. We have not had any companies come to us yet specifically with their problems, but we will see the downside and the upside of that. Certainly, we're seeing the upside with our fishermen, our shrimpers, for example. Now that they're talking about tariffs on imported shrimp, for example, we certainly stand to be the beneficiary of that. At the same time, we have global manufacturers in Jefferson Parish who export their product all over the world, and I think we're just monitoring that closely to see how that's going to impact our businesses.
Tell me about Churchill Park. What's going on there?
Oh, we just signed our design contract to start designing our regional food and beverage incubator, which will be built in Churchill Park. And that's going to be for food-related entrepreneurs from around the region can come there, rent space to produce their product, to get their product onto shelves at grocery stores and restaurants. And we're really excited about that because our food entrepreneurs are such a critical element to our economy and our landscape in Jefferson.
Any final thoughts, Jerry, before we let you go about some other things that are happening?
No, it's a great time to be in Jefferson Parish. We're excited about the future. We're excited about a lot of things happening, and I can't wait to come back on and talk about that oyster brand later this month.
I want to hear about them. Tell me real quick about the Radamo Suites. Did we talk about that or not?
Not yet. Just another project coming online in that Ochsner corridor on Jefferson Highway. 44 new hotel rooms, retail space, restaurant space for lease. Just continuing to beautify that area and invest in that area.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate your time and your efforts as always. Stay tuned because we're going to talk to Brooke Laser when we come back, give you an up close and personal about the Augusta National Golf Club and how maybe Hurricane Helene could have changed the iconic golf course, specifically Amen Corner. I heard that they maybe brought some full-grown trees in so as not to change the complexion of the course for after the hurricane, so we'll talk about that. Then we'll talk with Larry Carter, president of Louisiana Federation of Teachers. We'll have to see what happens with the special session with the teacher pay raise because it's kind of in limbo after Amendment Number 2 failed. So we'll talk about that and more. Then we'll talk about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, get Simone Maloz's take on that. She's with Restore the Mississippi River Delta. So a lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL, right now. Time for WWL First News. All right, 7:38, 22 till 8. It is time again to try Brooke Laser live from Augusta National Golf Course, where the Masters is being held this weekend. Brooke, sorry we had that low technical issue. You were saying that if your friends called the golf course classic, or what was it? What did you say they told you?
They said that if I use the words special or cherish one more time, I'm losing my badge.
Well, what should you say?
Right? It's tough to come up with another set of words because, like we were discussing, Tommy, it's just such an honor to be on these hallowed grounds whenever there's the chance. But each year that I've been fortunate for attending, something has been different or unique or improved or added to sort of allow patrons to have a wonderful experience they don't even realize the intricacy in planning behind, right? So yesterday, for example, I was able to tour a new parking garage on either side of Magnolia Lane. In the past, there have been new tunnels that were built for the quick process of transporting pimento cheese sandwiches and, of course, the egg salad sandwiches from across the street where they're all made locally. Just different unique experiences like that I really appreciate logistically. But as a patron who is attending this day, the members and the, you know, planners make each person on those grounds feel extremely special, which is the best part.
You've seen the golf course. Any changes since Hurricane Helene?
You know, Hurricane Helene really devastated this town, and having returned here, I can so clearly see the difference in the lacking trees, and it's quite vast, especially in places on what's called the Hill, close to the National. But if you are a patron who's not attended before, of course, you would hardly know. And I've heard from a member that everything looked just about perfect within the month of Helene making landfall. So, yes, there are some differences. On Magnolia Lane, as you're coming down and looking onto either side, you can notice a few spots where the oak trees have been slightly cut back. And then, as you and I talked about, when you get towards Amen Corner on 13, the most visible difference is on the left side of the course where you would attempt to make a dog leg, which is a challenge. The pine trees that once made that shot especially difficult are gone, and there are new ones, but they're visibly shorter. So it'll be interesting to see if that affects play as we head into the weekend. But otherwise, you really would not notice a difference.
Brooke, thank you so much. I hope you have a great time. We appreciate the report, and it'll be interesting, Mike. But the one good thing is that obviously everybody plays the same course, so it'll affect everybody the same, and maybe 13 might be maybe a little easier, lend itself. And for people that don't know, Amen Corner is 11, 12, and 13. 13 is a par 5, reachable in 2, and maybe it'll become more reachable in 2, more eagles, and we're all for that. Thank you, Brooke Laser. Have a great time.
Thank you, Tommy. You do the same.
All right, you bet. Live from Augusta, that's Brooke Laser.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's. So thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy!
This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, PSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every hue from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
when you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Alo, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Alo, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
The details behind the Diddy indictment. Taylor Swift's stalkers. Jerry Lee trying to kill Elvis. Disgraceland dives into the dark side of entertainment every Tuesday. Follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
WWL Channel 4 meteorologist. We'll take a break, come back, talk about teacher pay raises with Larry Carter here on WWL. All right, 7:48, 12 till 8 here on WWL. We were scheduled to talk to Larry Carter, who is the president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, about a pay raise. And as I understand it, we're having a hard time getting a hold of him. I can't see what you're telling me. What are you telling me? Do we have him or don't we? We do have Larry Carter. All right. Larry Carter joins us now, President of Louisiana Federation of Teachers. How you doing, Larry?
Good morning, Tommy. Good morning.
Let's talk about Amendment 2 failing and what that means for a Louisiana teacher pay raise.
Yes. Well, for Louisiana pay raise right now, with that amendment failing, it's just like every year. It's uncertain now, even more so, because again, I think I said last time, there was nothing in the governor's legislative budget that spelled out that that supplemental pay would be guaranteed for teachers and school employees. So with it failing, we don't know. We're actually getting ready to kind of start talking about what we have to at least fight for in the legislative session again. So it's once again, every single year, we're going hoping that a now temporary supplement will at some point become a permanent pay raise for school employees and teachers. So that's our journey every single year. We're going back and fighting for a pay raise.
Let's go back to Amendment 2. If it had passed, that would have done what?
It would have turned that supplement into a permanent pay, that $2,000 for teachers. It would have turned it into a permanent pay raise as opposed to it being a supplement, meaning it could now become a permanent part of teachers and school employee salaries, and it could not be taken away. Now, at any point, if there's a budget shortfall, the governor and the legislature could say, we don't have enough money to pay it, so it goes away. So that means there would be a reduction in take-home pay for teachers and school employees.
So it would have been codified had the amendment passed. Now we're back to having, what, no stipend in this year's budget? So there would be, in essence, a pay cut or what?
Yes. In fact, we're waiting to see if there is another way in which the legislature and the governor will find monies to actually keep the supplemental pay, the stipend. And it's uncertain right now. There's a rationale we're hearing that if there's ways to move monies from other areas, that the governor legislature could, at least for next year, pay that supplement again. But then the following year, it would be uncertain again. But if that amendment had passed, that money would have been realized and it would have actually been able to make those supplements permanent.
So where do you go from here with the legislature? Are you in contact with legislators that are going to propose this as, what would it be, an amendment to the budget, or what's the process here?
That's what we're trying to find out. I know there's appropriations and the finance committees that are meeting this week. We're waiting to see what decisions will be made in terms of, budget allocations. And it could be that it may be a charge from the legislature to the governor to actually find monies from other places and keep that supplement. So it will probably have to be an amendment to the budget or some additional funds recognized for that particular purpose.
So as it stands now, just so I get this right, if nothing is done, teachers will be looking at a pay cut from last year?
That's correct. They will have less take-home pay than they did the year before.
And do you have any, how much per teacher is, can you break it down?
Yes, it will be $2,000. It will be $2,000 less for teachers and $1,000 less for all support employees.
All right. So you'll keep us posted on what happens next?
Yes. We certainly will.
What are you hearing from the teachers in the union if nothing's done?
It's right now we haven't been here, to be honest. We're going to be doing a survey again to kind of poll that and kind of see where that stands. I know every time we've done a survey every single year leading into the session. We had one started probably around September, and it just ended last week. And the number one priority for us is pay and compensation. And it polls right around 92%.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Hope you stay in touch, and we'll see what happens, because I think we all need to value our teachers, and I don't think anybody wants to take a $2,000 pay cut. 7:54, 6 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. Beautiful spring day, beautiful spring week ahead. Get out and enjoy it before it turns summertime, I'll tell you that. French Quarter Fest, we're going to talk about the security measures that are going to be in place for that with Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for the City of New Orleans, next half hour. Right now, though, we're joined by Simone Malaz, our friend's campaign director for Restore the Mississippi River Delta, to talk about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. Good morning, Simone. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. So yesterday I was talking to Keith Hinckley of Plaquemines Parish. He said it was a win that this happened. I'm guessing that you don't see this 90-day pause on work as a win at all, and I want you to have a chance to give us the other side of it.
It's really hard to believe that anybody would say delaying a critical restoration project as we approach another hurricane season is in any way a win. So we still stand firm, Tommy, that this is a critical solution to Louisiana's future that doesn't just have environmental implications, it has economic implications as well. And we say this over and over and over again, we do not have time to lose when we talk about Louisiana's future.
So I'm looking at the newspaper story here at NOLA.com that was written by, I always like to give credit, Mike Smith, and it quotes Gordon Dove as saying that things costing us a fortune right now, so we have to quickly suspend it for 90 days. He also said that $500 million's been spent so far and that it would cost, I think, $380 million had been set aside to help those affected by the project, including commercial fishers and buyouts for homeowners. He says that's not going to be nearly enough compensation, and he's worried about the prospects of lawsuits. So is this about, in your opinion, as far as you know about money? Let's talk about the money aspects of it. Is the money there to pay for it, or is this all about seeking more compensation for fishermen? Tell me your side of this.
Tommy, those are some really big numbers that you're throwing out there for sure. This project, also a reminder that we've been talking about the delay to this project for a year now, for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that all of the money was in place when we broke ground and we began construction in 2023. And it is a big number, and that there is a considerable amount set aside for construction. You also have to pay for land rights and insurance. But yes, that mitigation money was included as well. Over $375 million. And there was a very careful and considerate process that considered the impacts to what would happen if this project came online, what could happen, what may happen. And that money was set aside for that. There's also some important numbers when it thinks about how you monitor the project, and something that sounds really unsexy, but adaptive management means that when you put a project in place, what conditions have changed around you that you may need to adjust that project. Tommy, all of that was in place, the money, the permit, and we were already on under construction before this began. I'd also like to point out that things cost a lot of money nowadays, lots of money. I think the New Orleans airport came in 100% over. Mm-hmm. The levee protection systems that we're putting in place are costing more and more and more. And we owe a cost share to that. We owe portions of that, even if the federal government comes in and pays for that. And what we're suggesting with this project in particular is protecting the protection, further protecting communities, and making that similar investment in the communities of coastal Louisiana.
So is this about, I'm trying to get a handle on this, Simone, is it about the project running over and the state wondering where the money's going to come to complete it? Or is it about additional money for compensation? What do you understand it to be?
It's really hard to find that answer, Tommy, because this has not been talked about publicly, because there have been no opportunities to discuss this except for the few forced opportunities that maybe some of the few legislators, et cetera, have allowed during their committee time. And so that is a huge problem in this process, is the transparency. For nearly a decade, 6 years on a permit alone, there were public conversations, there was transparency, there was information exchange, and we have not had that. So we can't get down to the real cause of the delay, except for that it seems that politics are winning over science.
All right, let me take a break. We come back. Keith Hinckley texted me a picture yesterday of a map with a blue dot over what appears to be water, but he said that's Spanish Pass, and that in the area of Spanish Pass, I don't want to misquote him here, but he said it's a marsh and ridge restoration. He drove his truck to where the blue dot is, and that he said that was accomplished with dredging. Tony Alford, who chairs the Governor's Advisory Commission on Coastal Affairs, said that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that they don't have time to wait 50 years to restore the coast, and that basically dredging is the answer. And I'm paraphrasing him here. Let's take a break. You can respond to all of that when we come back. We're talking about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. $500 million, as I understand it, has already been spent on it. There are concerns about the money, and I don't know if it's about the building costs or the state finding the money or about compensation for oyster people or people, fishermen, that will be displaced by it, that according to Gordon Dove. But we're trying to get to the bottom of it, and we'll address the engineering, the dredging part of it, and so forth when we come back. Right now, 821 traffic on WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Simone Malaz, campaign director for Restore the Mississippi River Delta, talking about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. Looking at a story here, a post from the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority 2023, May of 2023, less than 2 years ago, then Governor John Bel Edwards saying, "We're standing on what was once open water, now nearly 2,000 acres of restored marsh and ridge." And it says, goes on to say, a Spanish Pass project restored over 6 miles of ridge west of Venice, built over 1,670 acres of marsh, nearly 11 million cubic yards of sediment, making it the largest marsh and ridge creation project by both acres built and volume dredged. So I guess, Simone, what the question is, can you make a comparison between what happened with Spanish Pass and the Barataria Basin Ridge and Marsh Creation Project to the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion? Gordon Dove's advocating a smaller version of that along with the land bridge that they mentioned. Your thoughts on his alternative plan or their alternative plan?
Yeah, I've been to that project, Tommy. That is a great day when you can drive on a project. But the fact of the matter is that I hate that people put the dredging against this diversion, because really we need all those solutions. But dredging problems don't address the root cause of the problem: sediment starvation, subsidence, lack of fresh water, sea level rise. It's a temporary solution. And the way we were thinking in coastal Louisiana was not just what could help us today or tomorrow, but what could help us in the future. We have this one-time opportunity with this tragic event with Deepwater Horizon, where we got this money to mitigate for the damage that was done to us, and we wanted to make investments in Louisiana's future. Dredging certainly accomplishes some of that, but it doesn't address the root cause, and costs for dredging go up as well. But I don't want to be anti-dredging. We need all of these solutions, and the fact of the matter is that we don't have time to waste trying to decide a solution that was already decided upon.
So Alford is saying, the governor's advisor is saying that we can't wait 50 years for the result of the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion to show fruit, that basically they got to start dredging now and do what's similar to what they did at Spanish Pass, and also this land bridge that they're talking about, and also kind of like scaling down the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. I don't know if half a loaf is better than none or half a loaf is useless. Thoughts?
So we have a couple of smaller diversion projects, which are freshwater diversion projects. They're not sediment diversion projects, so they do something different. We already have some of those on the landscape, and we know what impacts they're having on the basins. It's been a long while since we've studied a smaller diversion, over a decade, for parts of Plaquemines Parish entering into the basin. And the fact of the matter is, it's not going to take 50 years. We've seen places like Neptune Pass and other areas that have grown significantly when the time is right to capture that sediment in the river. And so the science says something else, what's happening, and our eyes see something else that's happening in coastal Louisiana on what we can do with the power of the river.
So bottom line, one, the governor's people say that you're wasting time losing time with the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. You're saying we're wasting, losing time by delaying this for 90 days and then maybe coming up with a smaller version. Give me some final thoughts here, Simone.
Yeah, there's a very specific process on how we can spend that money here in coastal Louisiana. So any solutions are still years away. We still need the science, and there's still a process to follow there. So the most immediate answer is to continue to build Mid-Barataria as permitted, as funded, and as 10 years of science and public discussion led to.
And I'm going to be late here, but I don't care. So what happens from here? Is the governor, does he hold all the cards when it comes to this, or is there any legal action planned?
It sounds like they have given this 90-day window, and I guess the contractor has moved out some of their heavy equipment. There has been a lawsuit that is on the parish level that's filed, and some residents have asked to intervene in that case. And so some of that will happen within that 90-day period, as well as the Louisiana legislature considering the annual plan that has over $500 million for this project in that plan as what they want to do in the next year or so. And so that will move through the Louisiana legislature and I'm sure spur quite a bit of discussion.
Thank you, Simone. We'll talk to you again. Simone Malaz, campaign director for Restore the Mississippi River Delta. We'll talk to Colin Arnold about French Quarter and festival and security concerns when we come back a little bit late. Time now, WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9. A lot of people look forward to the French Quarter Festival every year. As a matter of fact, last year, I think it drew some like 950,000 people, and it gets bigger and bigger every year. Colin Arnold joins us now, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for the City of New Orleans, to talk about some of the security measures that are in place and how or will be in place and how it could change your experience. Good morning, Colin. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Tell me, first of all, as it relates to the Bratton study Bratton plan. Is this part of that? Is this part of their recommendations, and we've not seen the complete version of that report yet?
To my understanding, no. The Bratton plan is more addressing the future of Bourbon Street as how it's going to be secured, the whole idea about a pedestrian mall and that type of thing. I will say that what we've seen since January 1st is these event organizers like French Quarter Fest have reached out to the Bratton Group separately and asked for their input on events, and that happened in this case. And we're very much appreciative of the special events actually leaning forward and kind of identifying where they think there may be some problems, particularly when we're looking at like vehicle and pedestrian conflict. And we're working with Jazz Fest right now too. So, you know, we start meeting with special events months in advance, sometimes before they even have their permits filed, just to talk about anything new they're planning to do for the year. And we know that the event organizers want some sort of assurance about, you know, having their event when they, you know, on the scheduled date, and if there are any big changes, that they want to be a part of it and know about it. And that's what we're really doing right now. So there's a lot of collaboration going on, and some changes were made to French Quarter Fest, but I don't think the public will notice them, you know, all that much.
All right, so I got my map open right now. Tell me what changes have been made.
Really, it's more upgrading. So we used to protect Royal Street, the stages that they set up on Royal Street, the smaller stages, with the metal, what we call bike rack barricades, those Mardi Gras-type barricades mm-hmm. we see along the parade route. Those will be upgraded to both
What do you call those, Colin? I've always barricades. Wondered what they're called. What are they called?
We call them bike racks.
Bike racks. Okay, go ahead.
Because they kind of end up being bike racks.
Well, I've always wondered about the terminology. I like to learn new things. They call them bike rack barriers, right?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
So they'll be upgraded to water barriers, which will be filled, and then also concrete barriers in certain locations, just to really limit the amount of potential for vehicle and pedestrian conflict. And so that'll be along Royal Street and then also along North Peters and Decatur, where we have those areas where there's lots of people coming in.
So I saw a thing from a story rather at NOLA.com. I always like to give the reporter credit. Sophie Kasakov, quoting Hans Gaudier, an assistant superintendent, is saying that it's going to be harder to drive around, and that residents should avoid driving, and that basically, they're gonna have to find alternative routes to get there. Tell me what that means and what that's gonna. We're just using everything we can. Let me quote him directly to make sure that the public is safe. And he added that people are gonna have to look at a different way of getting there rather than driving. So talk about that, if you will.
I mean, that's pretty much what I'm referring to. You know, Royal Street is gonna be closed off essentially between Bienville and I want to say Toulouse. So, or maybe St. Louis, I have to check on it. But the essentially that kind of grid of Bourbon Street, particularly at night, but during the daytime, during the festival hours, you know, Bourbon, Royal, and Decatur is going to be, you know, really difficult to pass by vehicle, probably impossible because of the barricades we're using. Mm-hmm. So what he was recommending was that people use they go down further down to St. Peter is going to be their first avenue to be able to get, you know, across, I guess, from the river towards the lake in the French Quarter.
Are there any shuttle buses running for this event at all?
They don't run shuttle buses. We obviously, with all of these, we encourage people to park outside the quarter wherever they can, whether it be in the CBD or, you know, up along Rampart or further, and then either walk in. If you have the opportunity to use RTA, the streetcar, the buses, a bicycle, walking, anything alternative as far as or rideshare, I should add as well, is going to be a much easier experience than trying to drive down there in the headaches that you're going to experience with that.
And even with the rideshare, they can't drive either, so you might have a little bit of a walk. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back with Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security Emergency Preparedness for New Orleans, talking about the French Quarter Fest. You got any questions? 504-260-1870, and I'll pass them along when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:57, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security Emergency Preparedness for the City of New Orleans, our friend. Colin, so if you, I'm looking at the map, if you could give me a corridor and outline the streets where no vehicle traffic will be allowed, it would be what?
If you're looking at that map, you'll see those red hash marks. Anywhere those are is going to be closed off during the festival hours.
Yeah, I'm not looking at that map. So you're talking about Canal to what? Or are you talking about
essentially Iberville to Dumaine and Decatur to Bourbon is going to be very difficult to get through during the day because of the smaller stages, particularly on Royal Street.
And even without that, the French Quarter Fest, I haven't been in a couple of years, but when I went, it was extremely crowded, and I know it's grown since
it's huge.
Then.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking almost a million people over 4 days. And then we do a traffic, on-and-off traffic closure on Decatur, which really now during the day is just a closure. It used to be years ago we would be able to open up and let traffic through between acts, but now there's so many people down there that that traffic chute, which is at North Peters and Canal, is just closed essentially from when the gates open at 10 until 7 p.m. when they strike the last act for the
evening. So it would seem to me parking, driving in a quarter is going to be crazy, so maybe stay to the other side of Canal Street. Catch the ferry from the West Bank if you can and walk. Those would be better alternatives?
Yeah, RTA is going to have extra buses and both ferries will be out. So, you know, I think that that's an excellent alternative, or coming in from the Esplanade side of the quarter as well.
And there will be police presence to watch areas, not just at the French Quarter, but people that are trying to access the festival and leave, right?
Correct. Federal law enforcement, Coast Guard, they'll all be down along the riverfront as well as about 200 NOPD. They'll be wearing a new festival uniform. It's going to be basically polo shirts and shorts, which is something that the mayor was and the police chief really wanted to address some of the morale issues of wearing.
All right. Thank you, Colin. 909, we get a lot of text here on the Okanagan Jeweler Talking text line, 504-260-1870. Every now and then, one of them will tickle my fancy, and it is a long text, but I'll read the second to last sentence of it. All that stuff we learned in civics was BS. Well, I got to tell you, however crude that may sound, that's a thought I have, especially after I took this job decades ago and started to delve into politics and what actually is involved and how it actually works, as opposed to what they teach you in civics. But again, I guess when you're raising kids, you can't jade them early on, right? You got to tell them ideally the way the world works, and then from there they learn their own lessons. I know they say you should never discuss religion or politics. Well, buckle up, because we're going to talk about both of them together with Jeffrey Lehman, a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning. Very good. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. You know, one thing reading the study that you all did, it makes me think that the adage that while people are not predictable, groups of people are, right?
Sure, sure. No, that's very true.
Tell me about this study and how the relationship between religion and U.S. politics, and how you even go about, I guess, quantifying this or establishing who believes what religiously and then who believes what politically.
Well, we do it through surveys, mostly taking random samples of all Americans. We've done my colleague David Campbell and I have done a series of surveys over a decade from about 2012 to 2021 that we called the Secular America Studies, and trying to get a handle on this growing group of people that that are generally known as the nuns, not the nuns that wear habits, but the people who, when they're asked what their religion is, say none, no affiliation. That's been growing rapidly. If that was a religious tradition itself, it would now be the largest one in the United States. Bigger than Catholics, bigger than evangelicals, four times larger than Southern Baptists, for example. So we've been trying to get at the question of What are the consequences of this rise of the nuns for politics, and what are the causes, and is politics one of the causes? On the consequences side, what we have found is that you can't really think of the nuns as just one big block of people. What you have,
Professor, let me jump in yep. for a second. When you say nuns, N-O-N-E-S, are you talking about non-religious?
Yes. Yeah, non-religious
Let's
people,
use that,
people who have no
if you don't
religious
mind.
Affiliation.
We're an extremely Catholic sure. town, and I just want to use that instead because people tune in for a couple of minutes yep. here, a couple of minutes there, they're going to hear nuns and go ballistic. So we're talking about
sure.
non-religious,
sure, sure.
if we can.
Non-religious people, you really have to distinguish between people who are simply non-religious, who never attend church, don't pray, don't read scripture, but don't really believe anything else. And then there is a segment of those people that we call secularists or seculars. And those are people that are really committed to secular beliefs, belief in science and reason and evidence as a basis for understanding the world, get their, some might get their path to living from the Bible. These people get it from books of philosophy or science.
So wait, let me slow down for a second. So there are,
sure.
there is a difference between secular and non-religious. Those should not be used interchangeably, right?
Correct.
And what is the difference?
As we say, well, the difference is, as we say in the book, being non-religious is not being something, not having religious beliefs, not attending worship, not praying. Being a secular means what you are. It's a set of positive beliefs about science, reason, evidence, as the basis for sort of navigating the world, navigating life, finding meaning. It's you often hear the term secular humanism, and humanist thought means we don't need to look to a God or something supernatural for the foundations, our moral foundations. We look to human history and human experience. So these seculars or these secular humanists are people who have these positive beliefs in the secular, in human experience, science, reason, evidence as sort of their rules for living, just as many other people have religion, scripture, church as their basis for living. And those two groups of people, the non-religious and the seculars, are very different politically.
Are seculars and non-religious both atheist or maybe non-religious may not be, but I don't know. You tell me, Professor.
Well, many of the secular people would classify themselves as atheists, but not all, and actually not even most. Some would think of themselves as agnostics. Some might think of themselves as being, spiritual, but not religious. And our argument is that you can even be religious and secular. You can participate in religion in some level. You could be a good, a Catholic. You could be an Episcopalian. You could be a Jewish person, but still have this strong belief in science and reason and evidence and human experience as a way of sort of navigating the world. So we actually do find some overlap between people who are religious and people who are secular. Most secular people are not religious, but most non-religious people are not secular. In other words, they just sort of don't believe anything. They don't believe in religion. They don't participate in religion, but they also don't hold these secular beliefs that the secularists do.
So let me jump in real quick and ask for you to define difference, because I'm going to text on this, and we presume things that sometimes people aren't aware of. Difference between an atheist and an agnostic?
Yeah, an atheist is just somebody who is sure that there is no God. An agnostic is somebody who is not sure that there is a God. So that's the difference. In terms of politics, there's really no difference, we found, but But an atheist is just a level of certainty that an agnostic doesn't have.
I want to open the text line here at 504-260-1870, officially the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and text line. If y'all have any questions or comments about yourself, your religious beliefs, your political beliefs, you're welcome to text them in, and I'll pass them along to Professor Jeffrey Lehman, a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, about this study and this book that they put out about changing religious landscape and what it means for U.S. politics. Professor, let me throw my own case in here, okay? I have cobbled together my own set of religious beliefs. I don't go to church anymore. I don't mean expose too much of my life here. I pray the rosary daily, but I think a lot of the Catholic stuff is crazy. I think the Bible is a nice book of stories on how to live your life, but I don't think it's literal. Where would that put me besides, you know, crazy?
Well, it might put you in the spiritual but not religious category, mm-hmm. which is also a growing group of Americans. Depending on the survey and the questions they're asked, you might be classified as non-religious because you're not really participating in organized religion. You have some conventional religious beliefs, and if you're praying the rosary, you're obviously engaged in a prayer life. So I wouldn't classify you as non-religious, but a lot of the people in the non-religious category, this growing group of Americans, they sometimes float back and forth between religion and non-religion. They don't float back and forth between daily mass attendance and not being religious, but they might float back and forth between sort of a Christmas and Easter Catholic or attend mass a few times a year and being non-religious, just sort of depending on how they feel about religion at a certain point in time. And what we found is that how people feel about religion can have a lot to do with politics and how closely they see politics mixed up in religion.
I think by myself, my own personal judgment is if I go to church on Easter and Christmas, then that makes me a hypocrite. Because if I go on Easter and Christmas, I should go every Sunday. That's just the way I look at it, logically. So I guess I'm kind of secular in that I do believe in science, I do believe in philosophy, I do believe in logic.
Yes. Yeah, and that's we would classify you as a secular person, and we might classify you as one of our religious secularists, you know, people who have some religious practice, and some of these people actually do attend worship services. But they also believe in science, philosophy, logic, reason, evidence pretty strongly. That's where we would put you. And politically, what we find is that those religious secularists are actually the most likely to participate in politics.
That's right. Keep going. Keep going with your analysis of me. I'll tell you if you're right or wrong. You're right there also. Go ahead.
They tend to be Democrats, they tend to be relatively liberal on most political issues.
I'm fiscally conservative, socially liberal. I don't care what you do with your life so long as you don't affect me. But when it comes to taxes, I want you to be responsible with the money you take from me. Am I fitting right in?
Yes. Yes. I think so. I think that fits pretty well.
Well, thank you, Professor. I appreciate the therapy session. Bill my insurance company. I'm just kidding. Let me take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about these four groups. Religionists, non-religionists, secularists, and religious secularists, and how they vote and how that translates into politics. Interesting conversation with Jeffrey Lehman. He and his partner, David Campbell, got a book out about religion and politics and different groups of people and how they tend to lean, etc. If you want to tell me a little bit about yourself, text in at 504-260-1870, and I'll pass it along. Back in a flash, WWL. 9:27, talking to an interesting gentleman, a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, Jeffrey Lehman, about a book that he and David Campbell wrote, 2021 Secular Surge, A New Fault in American Politics. A couple of texts real quick, Professor. Somebody said, Everybody listening knew you were a liberal before you said anything, Tommy, so don't worry about that. Well, that's no secret. I've for years been saying socially, I don't care what you do. I think it's all about control. I don't want the government controlling socially what people do. Unless it hurts me, then I do care, and also, again, be very conservative with my tax money. Other people are texting in about, why do you pray to this one? Why do you pray to that one? Why do you pray to the other one? Let's talk about, I guess, the four groups that the book divides people in: religionists, non-religionists, secularists, and religious secularists.
Yes.
Have at it, Professor.
Well, these are groups, you know, we have our surveys. We ask people a number of questions about what they do religiously, what they believe, how they practice faith, do they practice faith, do they pray? And we ask a series of questions about, you know, belief in philosophy, science, evidence, reason. And so we have scales of how religious you are and how secular you are. And based on those two scales, we can form these four groups. And so the groups that you would think about when you think about religion and politics are religionists. These are people who are high in religion. They pray, they go to church, they read the Bible, and they're low on our secularism scale. They don't give much credence to philosophy, science, evidence. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have our secularists. These are people who place a lot of emphasis on logic, philosophy, science, reason, evidence. But they don't, you know, they're not religious. They don't believe in God. They don't belong to a religious denomination. They don't attend. They don't pray. But then there are sort of these hybrid groups. The non-religionists are the people who are low on both. They're not religious. They're not attending. They're not reading scripture. They're not praying much. But they're also not secular.
It says here, Professor, let me jump in real quick. It says they're defined by what they are not, not what they are. What does that mean?
Well, it just means that they're kind of nothing, at least when it comes to religion and secularism. They're neither religious nor secular. So these are just people who aren't particularly interested in religion, don't believe it, but they also are not strongly philosophical or evidence-based or based in humanism or reason. And then the religious seculars are some of both. These are people who are attending, do belong to a faith, but also strongly believe in logic, science, reason, evidence.
So can you assign different religions to different groups or not really?
Not really. I mean, it's possible. We're not. So which religion you are is not part of this, but you're much more likely to find, say, the true religionists or the religious secularists in different denominations. There's not a lot of evangelical Christians who are religious secularists. These are people who are what we call religionists. They rely on religion, faith, way more than evidence, logic, science.
If it's in the Bible, it's true. That kind of thing. I'm not judging. So I'm just giving an example.
No, that's exactly right. You know, they're going to believe what a pastor, a priest, a religious leader says more than a scientist or a doctor. The religious secularists, you're more likely to find them in, say, an Episcopal church or a Lutheran church or in a Jewish synagogue, especially a Reformed Jewish synagogue, some Catholic churches. You're not going to find a lot of them in a Church of God or an Assemblies of God or a Primitive Baptist church or something like that. So there are some religious differences, but that's not really the core of what we're getting at.
So how does that translate into the voting booth or political beliefs or political support? And then, I guess, supporting the party to the point of donating and being an activist in the party, et cetera?
Yeah, so the kind of core of our party coalitions are the religionists and the secularists. The religionists are what we think of when we think of the Republican Party. We think of the religious right, the people who are hardcore Republicans, hardcore Trump supporters or Bush or Reagan supporters in the past. And they not only vote Republican and identify themselves as Republicans, but they're more likely to participate beyond that, to do some work for a party or candidate, to give some money. And on the other side, the secularists have really become the core of the Democratic Party. You know, the Democratic Party used to have a strong religious core, especially in the black church, but also among white Catholics. And there's still a lot of that. But the real core of the Democratic coalition has become these secularists. And they are the people that are most likely to vote Democratic, most likely to be active. They're also the people who are most likely in primary season to support the most liberal Democrats, people like Bernie Sanders or AOC or Elizabeth Warren. So if you think about the religious right, which we've known in the Republican Party for now more than 40 years, the sort of parallel to that in the Democratic Party is this secular left, although the secular left is not nearly as well organized as the religious right is or has been.
So how does, and I don't know if you all looked at this or not, but when it comes to either a Democratic or a Republican candidate, does the behavior of the candidate necessarily matter to the religionists or the secularists, or do they kind of ignore that? For example, Biden was a Democrat but an ardent Catholic. President Trump has had a checkered history when it comes to his personal behavior, but yet does very well among the religionists. I just wonder how that difference is parsed, if it is.
Well, that's a really interesting thing, and it's a really interesting change in American politics that's happened with the emergence of Donald Trump. Evangelicals, kind of hardcore religionists, used to tell pollsters that character mattered, a candidate's personal behavior mattered. You know, in the Bill Clinton years when there were sex scandals involving President Clinton, it was evangelicals saying, well, it's not just what you do in office, it's not just your policies, it's not just your positions, moral character matters. Donald Trump comes along, and now the evangelicals are actually the least likely to say moral character matters. It's more of a transactional relationship. Many evangelicals will say, well, we supported people like Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush and Mitt Romney, and these are good Christian men, but they didn't deliver. Donald Trump, we're not sure if he's a good Christian or not, and we know he's done some things in his life, and he speaks in a crass way. But he delivers. He got us Supreme Court justices to overturn Roe v. Wade. He gets stuff done. And so there is a strong loyalty to Donald Trump among the religionists, especially white evangelical Christians, even though I think they know that he may not be the best Christian. You know, and the secularists are, you know, strong Biden supporters, despite his strong faith. They were strong Obama supporters, even though Obama talked a lot about faith. But they do tend to, if they have a choice within the Democratic Party, they're going to support people like Bernie Sanders, who says he's not an atheist, but he's not really a religious person at all. But mainly what they're looking for is a true progressive liberal Democrat.
So the politicians, the parties have to attract voters. I presume whether it's legitimate or not, they tell the voters what they want to hear, and that's part of the messaging. Does, when you look at 40%, I think it is the number you said, of religionists, 21% of secularists, and the others in between, where are the voters, and who would, you can't do anything if you don't get elected, so where do the parties right. have to go to get elected?
Well, that's what makes life easier for Republicans these mm-hmm. days, is because the core of their coalition and their message has been consistent. Even though policies have changed and the type of candidates, the core of their coalition have been these religionists, and particularly, you know, committed white evangelical Protestants, but also increasingly committed white Catholics. Those are their strongest voters. those are the core of the states where they win, and the South and the Midwest and the Great Plains states. And so they can preach, so to speak, a religious message consistently. Problem for Democrats is they still have strong cores of support among, you know, African American religious people, among, you know, some white Catholics, many Latino Catholics. So there's still a strong core of religious faith in the Democratic coalition. And in fact, when Democrats win, those kinds of people turn out and support Democrats in big numbers. When they lose, as in 2024, you'll notice they lost a lot among Latino voters, especially Latino men. They were even way down among Black men. So they need support from parts of their coalition that are quite religious. At the same time, their biggest givers, the people that are most likely to turn out, are these secularists, largely white, but they're also a little harder to find and mobilize. It's easy to find religious people. You know where they're going to be on a Sunday morning. You have their names and addresses on church rolls. Secularists, there aren't secular churches. There actually are some gatherings that are known as secular churches, but they're few and far between. So they're a little harder to mobilize than the religious right has mobilized the religious people. So it's a tougher task for Democrats when it comes to religion and secularism and keeping their coalition together and broadening that coalition.
One big giant question before we let you go, and that is, looking ahead to the future, where is the country headed in terms of religion? Where is it headed? What can we infer from that in terms of where it's headed politically? And as a wild card, you got tariffs going on now, the economy, some people saying around back to school, that's when it's really going to hit hard. Where does that factor in all of this?
Well, I wish I had a happier message for you, but I'm afraid the message on religion and secularism is the same as what we see in politics in general, and that's polarization. We're gaining the non-religious people, the secularists are becoming a larger and larger group. But at the same time, these hardcore religionists, the people who are there every Sunday or Saturday, depending on your faith, the people who are reading scripture and praying, they're not really declining. What's declining is sort of that middle, the people who are sort of occasionally attending, who are religious, but in a sort of non-zealous way. And so we're increasingly sort of becoming these two camps of secularists and religionists. And unfortunately, that fits really well with our polarized politics. And you ask about tariffs and economic policy that really wouldn't seem to have anything to do with this. But as these groups have become ingrained in the parties, they tend to fight as zealously about these economic issues like tariffs or health care as they do about abortion and gay marriage.
And the reason I ask, Professor, is that they say it's the economy, stupid, right? So where's the line drawn between what I believe on Sunday and the pocket that I have to reach into during the week?
Well, I think that's becoming increasingly wrapped up in religion or secularism. There are a lot of party politics and just some things that are going on in American religion with the prosperity gospel and things like that, that religion is increasingly preaching an economic conservatism. And these secularists are actually very liberal when it comes to social welfare spending and economic issues. So, shifting the focus to tariffs and taxes doesn't necessarily get us out of the culture wars. These issues are becoming as intensely debated as abortion and affirmative action and guns.
I would think if you're a politician and you can get people to believe that God is guiding you, you're golden.
Yes, if you're a Republican.
Okay.
Because if you're a Democrat, a big part of your coalition doesn't believe in God, and it's an increasing part. And so that's a tougher line to walk.
Professor, I appreciate it. I really do. I hope we get to talk to you again. Very interesting study and a very interesting analysis. We were talking to Jeffrey Lehman, a professor of political science, University of Notre Dame. He and his partner are co-author, I should say, David Campbell. The name of the book is, I had it in front of me here, Professor. What's the name of it?
Secular Surge. And we have a third author, John Green. I should mention him as well.
All right. And you're going to get that all the usual outlets if people want to read about it?
I'm sorry. I didn't catch that.
Secular Surge, the book. You can get it at all Amazon, all those different places?
Yeah, all those places.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. 9:42, 13 till 7. Quick look at traffic. Then we'll talk about the Ponchatoula Strawberry Fest on WWL. And we're back. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 9:48. Boy, a big Ponchatoula Strawberry Festival coming up. And here to join us is the queen of the Ponchatoula Strawberry Festival, Alexis Lee. How are you, Alexis?
I'm doing great. It is, of course, a great morning because we are waking up and it is Strawberry Festival week.
It is. Tell me how you become queen of the Strawberry Festival.
So I actually competed in a pageant against eight other fabulous women. We did an interview process. We did a self-introduction portion, and then we modeled on stage and answered an on-stage question. And it was just great spending the days with these awesome girls and competing for the chance to, you know, have this incredible opportunity. And it was just an awesome day, and I'm beyond lucky and blessed to be in the position that I'm in right now.
What was the question they asked you? I'm just curious on stage.
Oh, my question was, what is the biggest challenge that strawberry farmers face today?
And what is it?
I personally said that for the industry itself, it's probably going to be, specifically in our area, it's probably going to be generational farming or the lack thereof. And then for our farmers itself, of course, inflation. I mean, this economy is a struggle, and it's incredible that they're able to come back year after year and provide for us.
Tell me about the festival itself, because it happens, it starts when and runs till?
It starts on Friday, and it runs until Sunday at 7 p.m. It is the largest pre-harvest festival in the state of Louisiana. So on Friday, it actually starts at 12 o'clock. But it is the largest pre-harvest festival in the state of Louisiana, and it's just absolutely incredible, jam-packed, no pun intended, actually.
Yeah, there you go.
Jam-packed with fun. We have a parade on Saturday. It's enormous, and it's just absolutely electric with everyone there smiling, ready to come together and celebrate our farmers. We have our parade. We have an awesome entertainment lineup. We have, of course, awesome people, awesome food. On the festival grounds itself, it is made up of strictly nonprofit organizations. So we love supporting our nonprofits. And other than that, we have a few other events. We have an egg toss. We have a strawberry eating contest. And I'm just looking forward to a fabulous weekend. I mean, if you've ever been to the Strawberry Festival, you know that the one word to describe it is, to me, it's electric.
Mm-hmm.
So I am ready to roll.
Tell me what your duties are going to be this weekend. Do you have any?
My duty is to, of course, be there while promoting our festival and promoting our farmers. I like to say that my job is to be a walking, talking billboard for our festival and our farmers and the strawberry industry as a whole. So I'm just going to be there greeting everyone and thanking them for coming and, of course, enjoying everything that our festival has to offer.
What's your favorite thing at the festival? Do you have a food that you particularly like? Because I'm thinking strawberry ice cream.
I think that I like the fried strawberries.
Really?
I'm thinking that was my favorite last year.
What's that like?
I think they were fried strawberries. Like they battered them and fried them, mm-hmm. and I think they were on a stick, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure there was like a little sauce too. It made it a little fancy. It was very tasty.
Oh, you can't beat fried anything.
Oh, no. Everything fried, count me in.
And then put it on a stick. Tell me about yourself. What do? You go to college? What's your deal?
So I graduated from Southeastern Louisiana University last May. And right now I work for the Louisiana Office of Tourism in Baton Rouge, right next to the Capitol. So it's just awesome. It kind of goes hand in hand with what I'm doing for the Strawberry Festival this year. I mean, we're promoting tourism. We're promoting people to come out and see us and, you know, showing them and telling them how awesome either, you know, my job, our state is, and then with my other job, the Queen Life, telling everyone how awesome our festival is.
How do people find out more about it, Alexis?
So they can visit LAStrawberryFest.com, my apologies, or you can check our Facebook. Of course, you can just look up the Ponchatoula Strawberry Festival. We're on Facebook. And if you want to see some of my queen travels, my name's Alexis Lee, and I post everything that I go to, you know, on the every single weekend. I'm also on Instagram. It's LA Strawberry Queen. And, yeah.
I can't believe I missed the opportunity. Let me try it again. Alexis, tell me about the Strawberry Festival. You see what I did? Like Alexa, but Alexis?
No, actually, at my house, every time my parents talk to me, my Alexa goes off. So it's we're used to it.
And let me tell you something. Years ago, a guy wrote a story, an article, a book, whatever it was, that if you can sell, you'll never starve, you'll make a living. You, young lady, can sell, and you'll do very well in your life. Congratulations on being a Strawberry Queen. We'll see you out at the festival,
all
right?
Absolutely. I'm so excited to see y'all.
You bet. Thank you. Alexis Lee, Queen of the Ponchatoula Strawberry Festival. And all you have to do is search Strawberry Festival Ponchatoula. You get all the information you need. 954. Quick break. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.